Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to another segment of Let's Talk Fort Worth. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Thank you for joining us for what should be another great show. A reminder, we do not own the rights to the music you just heard. Also, please click tag and share. Tell someone Let's Talk Fort Worth is on the air. And tonight, we're talking about the Aaron Dean trial. Depending upon how things turn out with a former criminal attorney and Shelby County Criminal Court judge and TV personality, the Honorable Judge Joe Brown. We just finished day two of the Aaron Dean trial, and we want to know what the judge thinks. Now, y'all, that was my intro that I planned. However, I just finished text messaging back and forth with the judge a little while ago. He's in holiday mode. And at a holiday party. So I'm not sure if the judge can join us or not. It's going to be his decision, but I told him I would never, I respect him so much, I would never bring him on a show that he was not prepared to do. So it's going to be his call, but we have talked about it. So if he does not show tonight, I apologize. He only found out about the show on yesterday. That is somewhat of short notice. He was already in party, he already had the party invitation, so therefore it is what it is. So listen, one thing I always do is stay ready so that I don't have to get ready. So with that said, if we hear from the judge tonight, kudos, we would love to have him. If he can't make it, My apologies to the audience because I did not check on the fact that he had that party or find out about he had that party until today. But y'all, let's talk about the Aaron Dean trial. I got a lot to say. We just finished day two, but day one was very interesting. A lot is going on with that trial. And that said, I'm going to choose my words very carefully today. Don't want to step on any toes, but these are just my observations, my opinions. They may not be the opinions of anyone else, and I get that. But these are just my observations. During opening statement, let's talk about the prosecution. That's Dale Smith and Victoria Ford Ovlin. I felt like more could have been done to make the case. I thought, how do you say? It seemed like more like they were helping Aaron Dean than they were building a case for the state versus Aaron Dean, but that's just my opinion. I felt like the defense seemed to be blaming everyone but Aaron Dean. It seemed like they wanted to set the stage that Zion Carr said that Tatiana Jefferson went to the window and pointed the gun out of the window. That wasn't what Zion remembered, and we'll talk about that later. But it seemed like the prosecution was trying very hard to say, Zion say it, as though we're putting the burden of this whole trial on an 11-year-old who would have then been 8 years old when he allegedly made these statements. Also, I felt like the prosecution was trying very hard to change what was a welfare call to an open structure call. I felt that in listening to him, it was as though what Mr. James said was not relevant enough for them to just go by what he said. The operator, in my opinion, maybe should have asked more questions since there was a difference between a 56, which is an open structure, and a 61, which is a welfare check. And we're going to talk more about that. And so I just think it seemed like he was blaming everybody but Aaron Dean. So it was about his training. It was about Zion said she took a gun to the window. It was about Mr. James, you know, didn't, you know, effectively convey that it was a welfare check as opposed to an open structure call. So what I would take away from day one was, as far as the opening statements is concerned, I would say if I were a 911 non-emergency operator and there was any question as to whether or not we're talking about an open structure or a welfare check, seems like the terminology should have been made clear by the operator. It seems to me that the operator should have said, "So, sir, are you saying you're concerned about your neighbor's welfare in terms of is there something maybe wrong with her as far as she's ill? Or are you saying that you're concerned about the door being open because you believe that maybe there's a burglary in progress?" And that's something that I did not hear on that particular call. And so I really question if we are really stretching, if you want to call it that, what Mr. James said versus what he should have been asked, seeing that the operator was the professional. Mr. James was just calling with his concern. So that said, I would think that if I were the trained professional and someone was calling in and I was confused in any way about what they meant, then it would have been easy for me as an operator to ask more questions. So let's listen to that call, and let's see if the operator asked enough questions that night.
Fort Worth Police Operator, inmate 73, what's the address?
I'm calling about my neighbor.
Okay, what's the address?
1203 East Allen Avenue.
Okay, 1203 East Allen Avenue. What's going on there?
Well, the front doors have been open since 10 o'clock, and I haven't seen anybody moving around. It's not normal for them to have both of the doors open this time of night.
Okay, you know if anyone is inside?
No, I'm not sure. Both of the calls are there.
Okay, bear with me. And they're in the driveway?
Almost the cars in the driveway, yes.
Okay. Can you give me a description, like a color of the vehicles?
Well, one's white and one's dark blue.
The white one is a sedan or a CV? Or pickup?
They're both sedans.
Okay. And what's your name?
James Smith.
Telephone number? 817. Gotcha. And are they usually home at this time?
They're usually home, but they never had both of the front doors open.
Okay.
With the lights on, like I can see straight through the house. Well, my sister woke me up. She stays across the street from them. I live on the opposite side of my sister.
And the address that you gave me, 1203, that's their address, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'll have an officer come by. They're already being dispatched now, okay?
Okay, appreciate it. I mean, it's just not normal for them to have both the doors open this late for that long.
Gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Again, if you listen to those calls, which the operator, and we'll talk more about it later as far as what the operator said, but he mentioned both cars are in the driveway. Those are my neighbor's cars. He said he was concerned about his neighbor. And so when I listened to the operator in day two's testimony, this really could have very easily been suspected as a welfare call. But why didn't she ask more questions to determine that? So, again, when I listened to the defense talk in day one in the opening statement, it appeared that they were making this all about 11-year-old Zion and what he said when he was 8 years old, scared, half naked. In the middle of the night, sleep deprived, had just witnessed his aunt being killed in front of him, taken to a strange location. It's in the middle of the night. It's 40 degrees outside. The wind is blowing, and they've had him sitting on the curb with a blanket around him with no shoes on. So with all of that going on in an 8-year-old's mind, he was supposed to be able to recant exactly what he said when he was 11. But we'll talk about that later. All right, y'all, so day one. After the opening statement, who do they call as their very first witness? 11-year-old Zion Carr. And Zion, I must admit, was so composed. He was everything a mother could be proud of. He took every question. I mean, and he looked them square in the eye and he answered them. And the defense asked Zion, at one point, was he one of those kids that would tell the truth? Really? That stuck out to me for what he said to a child. This child was traumatized when he was 8 years old, taken to an undisclosed location alone, no one he knew, people who didn't look like him, put him in a square box the size of a matchbox with someone who was sitting so close to him, their knees were touching if they had been sitting facing each other. But he was facing one direction and she was facing him. Was this an interview or was this an interrogation? You decide. But I saw the images and I couldn't believe that that's what he had been subjected to that night. But if you can believe either the 8-year-old or the 11-year-old Zion, I think there's something wrong with you. Because the 11-year-old was telling you what he remembers when he was 8 years old. But the problem with that, again, he was in shock. He was sleep deprived. He was half naked. He was taken to a strange building, talking to strangers he didn't know, unsure about what his situation or condition was. He was scared to death. And he was whisked up in the middle of the night and taken from the location. So with that said, was his statement given under duress? If that were the officers, they immediately had a attorney come to the scene within an hour. Why do you think they were there? To coach them. And then they have 72 hours to give a statement. So what I understand the Cleat attorney does, now whether or not this is exactly what happened, but I heard Officer Darch say this today, that the attorney comes there after a shooting or some terrible offense that has occurred where a police officer or a situation has occurred where a police officer is involved. And I understand that the Cleat attorney asks them questions and they're just allowed to point. Now, I don't know how much of that y'all believe, but that's what she said. You're just supposed to point. And then you have 72 hours for somebody to coach you as to what to say. And then after 72 hours, you give your statement. However, if you're 8-year-old Zion, you have no coaching. Your parents are not allowed to come with you. You are taken to an undisclosed location. None of your relatives even know where you are until it's over. And you are asked questions about what you just saw when your little brain may not even be able to process what you just saw. I mean, some people have mentally broke after seeing something like that. So did anybody psychoanalyze him that day to make sure that he was even able to give a statement? Little Zion, they said, gave a sworn statement. Well, what 8-year-old can give a sworn statement without a parental consent? I'm just asking, what 8-year-old can give you a sworn statement without parental consent? Without having an attorney there with him. I just asked y'all, that something ain't adding up. And just to tell us that we're supposed to now consider the testimony that he gave day one is maybe not as credible as the testimony he gave when he was 8, traumatized, in shock, scared, half naked, taken to an undisclosed location, interviewed by people who don't look like him in a matchbox, is more credible. Then I guess that's what they're going to go with. But I don't think so. I think anybody with a pea-sized brain would realize something's very wrong with anyone accepting any of Zion's testimony as to it being what happened. Zion is now 11 years old. When this occurred, October 12, 2019, he was 8 years old. Zion, when he went on the witness stand, he started out very friendly. He seemed at ease almost with the testimony. But after a while, it seemed like something switched. like he could not handle it anymore. Like maybe the pressure of all of this had become too much. And then they took the break. And I think it was the questions. I think when I saw things switching is when the defense was asking Zion about the video game that Tatiana Jefferson was playing with that night. It was something called Real Royale. And the defense almost appeared to be trying to make Tatiana Jefferson out to be someone who loved video games where you're shooting the bad guys. And I think I saw like Zion switch when he saw the line of questioning going down that road. I think that broke something in him that something shifted. And the defense appeared to be drilling him trying to get him to say, you said she had the gun pointing out the window. And I think Zion, he told them what he says he said was that the gun was at her side. Now the question is, the 11-year-old Zion versus the 8-year-old Zion, both of them are in trouble, if you ask me. 11-year-old Zion has had 3 years to grieve his aunt and had constant reminders of her death all over the news, all over everything he's been living for the last 3 years. 8-year-old Zion was traumatized. It had just happened. I mean, he had just lived his worst nightmare after having the most amazing day with his aunt. So, is the 11-year-old Zion more credible than the 8-year-old Zion? I say neither. I say the 8-year-old was so traumatized, his statement shouldn't be admitted, period. And I think the 11-year-old Zion is probably stuck in the 8-year-old Zion. And so that little kid probably died that day. A million deaths in the last 3 years, having to relive that over and over and over, as people say, justice for Tatiana Jefferson. By now he knows what that should look like. And so to be on that witness stand and be drilled like he was drilled, I don't know, y'all. Neither the 11-year-old or the 8-year-old is capable of having anything they said admissible in that courtroom. Little Zion Carr is not on trial. It's Aaron Dean. And we should not forget that. And this community should cover that little boy in prayer. This community should realize that, why are we putting the burden on an 11-year-old to tell us what happened when this is Aaron Dean's trial? Aaron Dean should get up there and tell us what happened. It doesn't matter what Zion saw. Zion was inside the house. Carol Dorch and Aaron Dean were on the outside. So it only matters what was seen from that outside that caused Aaron Dean to shoot that night. So when we look at this trial and we talk about guilt versus innocence, nothing should be based on what Zion Carr said. So Zion appeared emotional at one point, and then they took the break. When Zion came back from the break, it was almost as though he had broken. His whole countenance changed. He seemed agitated, frustrated to even be there. His answers were short. He seemed tired of the whole thing. He just looked like he wanted it to be over. And my heart just broke because I just wanted to say, somebody, please go get him off that witness stand. Do they want him to have like a mental episode where he just starts screaming You know, just how much do you put on the burden of an 11-year-old who wasn't even outside? They even said he saw a badge. Well, that should tell you something. How can he see the badge from his vantage point? Dean was off to the side of the window. He couldn't even go to the window. Tatiana didn't take Zion to the window that night. So when he remembers the badge, he probably remembers the shiny badge from when they came inside. I'm sure all the details are very confusing for an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old. So trying to get Zion to put the gun in Tatiana Jefferson's hand is scary. It just is. Because if he says he does not remember her having the gun in her hand, that's what he remembers. Because now he's had time to process it. That night he didn't. So he was being asked questions in a confused state and told to recant exactly what he saw. Now, y'all, most grown people can't do that. I've been told if multiple people are standing at the same corner and see an accident, these are adults, and they can't all tell you the same thing. I've been told that multiple times, that three different adults can be standing at the same intersection at the exact same time, an accident happens in front of them, and none of them will say exactly the same thing if they're separated. Why? Because the memory remembers what it remembers. Did I say it? Zion was traumatized that night, and I just don't know how much of the 8-year-old or the 11-year-old should be believed. It's almost as though when you witness something like that, I mean, you freeze. I mean, you absolutely freeze. Everything is chaotic. And you remember certain pieces of it, but other pieces, someone can coerce you into believing that you saw it. That you saw the gun in her hand, didn't you? Didn't you see the gun in your aunt's hand? Didn't you see? And then all of a sudden you think, they're saying that, so that must be what happened. So we're not even sure if what they're saying he said at 8 was coerced. Was it done under duress? Absolutely. Was he tired, sleep deprived, probably hungry, scared, cold, no shoes on, wondering where his mother, where his aunt, where his grandmother, who was going to come to save him, rescue him from all these people who didn't look like him, who were asking him questions about his worst nightmare. Anyway, y'all, you can decide for yourself, but I just thought something ain't right. And when the defense asked him several questions after the point in which he just seemed like he just switched. He said, I don't remember. I don't remember. I don't know. I don't remember. It's as though his whole remembrance just shut down. It's just like everything just froze. And he went blank. And he's looking at an audience full of strange people. Who takes him into a courtroom that intimidating and asking him to recant what happened that night? Projectors and lawyers and people he doesn't know sitting in the audience. And he told these people are the jury and this person is the judge and you're supposed to do this and act this way and don't act this way and address this. And come on, y'all. That's a whole lot of directives for an 11-year-old child. And then when you get used to all of that, then tell us what you remember on October 12, 2019, the night Aaron Dean killed your aunt. So I think I saw on the stand a little man who was stressed, tired, agitated, and just unable to continue with the testimony. Because again, quite a few of his answers was just like, I don't remember. It was like his mind was saying, please don't make me go there. Please don't make me go there. Please, I don't remember, as though he had had a block. So if he has a block to the point he can't remember, and then the 8-year-old was scared, tired, sleep deprived, probably hungry, grieving, confused, half naked, and then told to give a statement. I say they both should be thrown out. That's just my opinion. So they ended early when little Zion was not able to perform at the rate they wanted him to perform. They ended early. They said, okay, we're out of here for the day. And Monday happened to be Jim Lane, the lead attorney for Aaron Dean's case, funeral, because Mr. Lane had died the Sunday before jury selection. So his funeral was on Monday. So after they couldn't get Zion to perform, they closed down early for the day, and everyone who wanted to attend Jim Lane's funeral was allowed to do so. And then we had day two, as though day one wasn't bad enough. Day two begins, and they decide, well, we'll fix little Zion. We'll go and open the day with video of when he testified in this little tight matchbox that was rectangular in shape, and literally the seat in which the person who was interviewing him was sitting in was so close to him, if they had both been facing each other, they would have been touching knee to knee. They had Zion facing one direction and the adult sitting higher than him, looking over him, towering over him, asking him questions about what just happened. And they thought that was something we needed to see. I think if anything, that video, which was very hard to hear, was the worst thing you could have shown to make us believe that little Zion was capable of testifying that night. Or given a statement that night. He was crying. He didn't have any shoes on. He was emotional, appeared scared, alone, fragile, baby-like. I don't know any other words to put it. He was baby-like. I don't know how anyone could have felt comfortable taking a testimony from Zion or a statement from Zion that night in the condition in which or the state in which I saw him in. I couldn't have done it. There's no way in the world I could have felt comfortable talking to a child without his mother's consent after something like that and forcing him to talk to me about something that I knew he didn't want to talk to me about. I just felt like that was crossing the line. You can call it interviewed or you can call it interrogated. It was definitely under duress. Zion was scared. Zion was in shock. Zion was sleepy, was in the middle of the night, and he had just been through the most horrific night, day. I mean, what was a fun day with his aunt, it turned into a nightmare, but yet somebody wants you to tell them all about it. But you give the officers 72 hours to tell their stuff, their testimony. So y'all decide, interview or interrogate it. But either way, it was done under duress. Let's talk about Officer Carol Darch. That was the officer who was with Aaron Dean that night. Darch talked about the call coming in, and she chose to ride along with Aaron Dean that night. Or not along with him, let me be clear. She chose to be his backup. They were in two separate cars. She talked about going to the wrong address initially and then leaving the car parked at the wrong address, in front of the wrong address, and her and Dean walking to a Tatiana's house. But I question that part because I understood they came running from across the street. That said, a Tatiana lived at 1203. The opposite side of the street would be even numbers. So if you responded to an even number house, you weren't even on the right side of the street. So did Darch really go to the wrong house, or did Darch park around the corner, her and Dean, to show up for what they thought was a burglary call and not a welfare check? But in listening to her testimony, she mentions that she had a stroke in 2020. Two strokes, she says. Two strokes that affect her memory. But what I also heard was selective memory, as Ms. Darch could very easily recant all of her training, you know, all of this information about weaponry and what type of gear they have to have on very well. In fact, it was almost 100% yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, to everything the defense asked her that day or today. And the defense, I guess they thought we weren't paying attention. Y'all, they were leading her. They were dragging her all down the street. And she was saying, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, all the way. All the way. Pay attention. She didn't really answer any questions with an answer. It was only yes, sir. But when the prosecution asked her a question, it was almost always, I don't remember, I don't remember, I don't remember. Now, what kind of stroke do you have selective memory on? Memory was fluid when it came to training and exercise. Memory not so good when she's questioned by the prosecution. Is she fit to be an officer? If she's had two strokes and her memory's that bad? Can she recant what she saw under a crisis situation, on a critical situation? Is that even possible to have two strokes in 2020 and then come back and be on the street? Is that safe for any of us? I'm just asking y'all. She mentions a lot about the house being messy and the house appearing. Well, no, she didn't use the word messy. She used the word ransacked. And it looked like somebody had been looking for something and the cabinet doors being open. Well, was the house ransacked before or after the shoot? I'm just like, yo, I don't know. That's a question that somebody sent me. I'm just responding to that question. Was it ransacked before or after the shooting? Because the photograph that the prosecution showed of the living room didn't look ransacked to me at all. It looked like people lived there. And let me be clear. Tatiana Jefferson was a college student. And Zion was 8 years old. So Ms. Yolanda Carr, the mother of Tatiana Jefferson and the grandmother of Zion Carr, was in the hospital. So they had to run out of the house. So they didn't have to keep it clean. And who in their right mind looks at a messy house and calls it ransacked? But anyway, I digress. So she talks about the doors being open, but they never checked to see if you could go right in. Never thought about that. They never knocked, never announced themselves, didn't follow police protocol, didn't do any of that. But they proceeded to go under the carport. She stumbled, I believe, on the weed eater. They met up. They went on both different sides of the car, but they met up going toward the back gate. She doesn't remember who opened the gate. She remembers that they went in the gate, and some kind of way they were back to back. Okay. And after they were back to back, pretty quickly she heard Dean yell command. She says she's looking over his shoulder, and all she can see is a Tatiana's eyes that look like saucers to her. And then a Tatiana falls. She does not see a Tatiana with a gun. Mm-mm. She does not see the laser. Mm-mm. All she sees is a Tatiana fall after Aaron Dean shot her. But what she never said was he screamed police. She never said they knocked on the door and said police. So never, even after they entered the house, after the shooting, did anyone say police. Mr. Dean came in the house still screaming, put your hands up. Put your hands up. Never saying police. So, and y'all, I'm just recanting what I saw. Listen, I ain't add nothing to it. I promise you. This is what I saw. And if you go back and watch today's testimony, in yesterday's testimony, you will see the same thing. That's it. So, you don't have Zion at this point saying he saw the aunt with a gun. You don't have Carol Dorch saying she saw a Tatiana Jefferson with a gun for the green laser. But some kind of way, they're saying that she had a gun. And all of this is allegedly based on the fact that the police report stated that Zion said that she had a gun, took it out of her purse, and took it to the window and pointed out at the window. I'm going to let that marinate. But anyway, again, I digress. So the shooting has taken place. They're inside the house. Now, one thing, I'll go back to what Darch said. Darch never heard Aaron Dean say gun. After the shooting, it was never discussed between Darch and Dean that a Tatiana Jefferson had a gun. They just immediately run in the house. Aaron Dean runs to a Tatiana. And by the way, after the shot was fired, let's go back. After the shot was fired, you can hear a Tatiana Jefferson on the inside screaming and crying. So by this point, you know you shot a woman. So they go into the house. Aaron Dean screams, put your hands up, put your hands up. They find a Tatiana. They find Zion. Dorch gets with Zion and takes a blanket and puts it around him. Aaron Dean is over at the Tatiana Jefferson at one point. They say he moved the gun. Moved the gun. They say the gun was moved because
you're supposed to move the gun when somebody has a gun and they you know, they're shot. So I guess he's removing the alleged perceived threat. So he moves the gun. So I call that tampering with the evidence and messing with the crime thing. I don't know, you know, what the terminology is, you know, supposed to be, but in my estimation, that says, are you tampering with the evidence and are you, you know, compromising the crime scene? I don't know. But anybody has the right to be in their house doing whatever they want to do as long as it's legal. That said, if the house was messy, the house was messy. So how unfair is it to say that you entered the house because or you all's actions that night is okay because the house was messy and you saw the lawn equipment outside? It was her house, her yard. And what I saw missing in Dorch's testimony was failure to observe long enough to see what was going on, lack of discernment, poor analytical skills, failure to follow protocol, the unwillingness to stay still long enough to assess properly what was going on. I also see that the failure to just knock on the door is why we're here today. Just a simple knock on the door. So when you say you went to the backyard, the protocol says if it's an open structure that somebody was supposed to secure the doors. You can just secure both doors to the carport and the front door from facing Allen Street. So if someone was going to go and peek in the backyard, the other person could have secured the front, which was not done. So failure to pull up in front. Well, let's start with the operator. Failure to ask more questions. And then Mr. Dean and his partner failing to pull up front, failing to knock on the door, failing to stay still long enough to assess and analyze what was going on, and then poking in a very dark backyard. But let's go back to a very important point. The backyard was pitch black, but the light on was the light was on in the house. When Aaron Dean flashed the light in the window, that would draw anybody to the window. The air conditioner sits underneath the window. So Aaron Dean and his partner would have been off to the side of the air conditioner. So how could it have been that Tatiana Jefferson saw Aaron Dean that night when the flashlight is in her face and he can see her but she can't see him? Because he's in the dark backyard, remember? And she's just standing in front of the window. Poop it up. So they go into the house, but they fail to render aid to Tatiana Jefferson. Carol George says, oh, my concern was the child. I get that. But who was suffering more at that particular point, 11-year-old Zion or 23-year-old Tatiana Jefferson? So when Aaron Dean is picking up and moving the gun, when Harold Dorch is getting Zion the blanket and taking him outside and sitting on the curb. And according to her testimony, or according to Zion's testimony, Aaron Dean followed them outside. And at some point, Harold Dorch turns around and tells him to go back and check on Tatiana Jefferson and how she was doing. So Tatiana Jefferson is wounded. Every second counts, and everybody's outside. Now, we know little Zion didn't even know what to do, so we're not talking about him, but you got two adults who should have known a little something about CPR, who could have at least held her hand, told her it was going to be okay, told her to hold on. Anyway, so Harold Dorch, again, has selective memory. That's the only way I can put it. I mean, very selective memory. Very, very, very selective memory today. In and out. In and out. But it was very clear in her loss of memory, regaining memory, loss of memory, regaining memory, that it seemed to almost be like on automatic pilot. I don't remember, I don't remember, I don't remember, I don't remember. When she's talking to the prosecution. And then when it came to the defense, automatic pilot again, but yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. So literally he was leading on all the questions. And she was following, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And at some point, they came to the part about a question about Zion, and she began to cry. Or that, and she asked for the break. She kept saying something about muscle memory, muscle memory, muscle memory. I don't know what that means, but it was very scary to hear that she was alleging that an officer is just going to go off of muscle memory in making these split-second decisions instead of analyzing, assessing, you know, determining, you know, what's the next thing to do, discerning. No. This lady's on the stand talking about muscle memory. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell is muscle memory? And how is that relative to someone taking out their gun and shooting somebody because they appear at their own window when you're poking around in their backyard in the middle of the night? So I got to learn more about what muscle memory means in terms of police officers today. But that was the scariest thing I heard. I said, muscle freaking memory? As though literally, like, and I'm paraphrasing, y'all, and help me, please forgive me, but the muscle memory thing was almost as though to say, like, he's trained to, like, shoot. So, you know, he sees this person, and this person appears that he perceives the threat that's not there, so muscle memory says, shoot. That's his training. If I misunderstood what she said today, that's what I took from it. And I thought, that is the scariest thing I've ever heard. I can't believe that it's okay for someone to believe that muscle memory is a reason to or an excuse for someone to just shoot you. And I was trying to wrap my mind around, what is she saying? Because everything seemed almost to say reflexes, but we don't want people on automatic pilot. We don't want people ramped up that they don't know how to ramp down and determine that what they perceive as one thing may not be reality, and so therefore be able to switch back and forth in your discernment as to what your condition is at the moment. And so that part was scary. that part was really scary. And so, in my opinion, my humble opinion, y'all, and I listened to all of Carol Dorch's testimony, I didn't believe her. I did not believe her. I didn't believe her. I felt that her testimony basically was just enough to remove her from any responsibility she may have had for what happened that night, but at the same time saying somehow I didn't see anything. Some kind of way, I had my back turned, I heard this, I turned around, this was happening, that was happening, but anything significant about that night, the only thing I think she told the truth about, if the truth be told, I did not see a Tatiana's gun in her hand. Do I believe that she just saw a Tatiana's eyeballs and they looked like saucers to her? That part I didn't believe. I believe she saw more than just her eyeballs. And I think something about when they were talking about training was very scary, too. When they said something about like a silhouette, you know how when you go to the gun range and they have those, I forgot what they call those little target things that they shoot, but it almost seemed like she was saying that was like a cross between like him seeing that as a Tatiana Jefferson, and he's on muscle memory, so therefore he just shot. And I'm thinking, and I only listened once, y'all, I must admit that. But that was my perception of what she was saying. And after listening to Carol Dorch today, my thought is the city of Fort Worth is on trial. The Tarrant County District Attorney's Office is on trial. The Fort Worth Police Department is on trial. And so is Aaron Dean. I think, and I have analyzed this thing, y'all, and I've decided no matter which way it goes, it's going to be a win. Why is it going to be a win? Because if they find him guilty, somebody killed a Tatiana Jefferson, and that was Aaron Dean. Should he be held responsible for her murder? Absolutely. But if they find him not guilty, it shows the whole entire world that something's wrong with the Fort Worth Police Department. It shows the whole entire world that there's something wrong with the training. It shows the whole entire world that the way that the DA is handling this case from beginning to now has not been right. Has Aaron Dean been afforded every possible white privilege there has ever been in a trial in Fort Worth besides the affluenza kid? Yes, he has. From recusing the judge to all the delays, from never being arraigned until a couple of days ago, you know, to not wanting any media attention, to gag orders, you name it. You name it. I saw the witness list, y'all. It's got damn near everybody on the Fort Worth Police Department. It's long. It's very long. So everybody's to blame but Aaron Dean? I don't know, y'all. That's just what I took from it. But it's a win either way. And I prayed about it and thought about it. And I said, would they really let him walk and say he didn't do anything wrong and the girl was in her own home, minding her own business, not doing anything to anyone, not in the commission of a crime, didn't have any type of criminal history, had finished college, was in med school, the citizen that we all want to be? How can it ever be said that somebody should be held responsible for her murder? But then I, after praying about it and really thinking about it, I said, Fort Worth has been experiencing a population boom. 12th largest city in the country. Everybody's moving here. But I guarantee you people will rethink Fort Worth if Aaron Dean gets off, because people will begin to wonder what kind of city says it's okay. What kind of DA says it's okay?
What kind of jurors do they have in Fort Worth that says it's okay for Aaron Dean to kill someone who was doing absolutely nothing within seconds of going in that backyard? And when Darch told that lie that day that she didn't know where the window was, y'all, I've seen that backyard. And that window is just as you go into that backyard. They had flashlights that night. So you don't think they, I'm just saying, y'all, that part. So none of that made sense to me. So when they were talking about the laser beam guns and this, that, and the other, and Aaron Dean turned the laser off of the Tatiana's gun, the laser that nobody saw but him, did he turn it off or did he turn it on and then turn it off? I don't know. Y'all probably going to get in trouble for this show, but oh, freaking well. Somebody had to say it. And Judge Brown wasn't here to do it tonight because, unfortunately, the judge is in party mode. And I told him I respect him way too much to have him to come on a show that he was not prepared to do tonight. So the judge will be on another night, but it won't be tonight because I respect him too much to bring Judge Brown on when he's not prepared to do a show. And again, I only asked him yesterday to come on. So it is what it is. And that's why they say you have to stay ready so you don't have to get ready. So I'm at that point. I watched the testimony for these 2 days. So we're going to go to the phone lines and listen to some other folks and what they think. Listen, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Let's Talk Fort Worth. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. And tonight, we were supposed to have Judge Joe Brown in the building, but I did not book Judge Joe Brown until yesterday. That was my fault. And that said, Judge Joe Brown had a party that he went to tonight, and he was going to chime in from the party, but I told Judge, I was like, I don't think that's a good idea. So because I love him so much and I respect him so much, I did not think this was the show for him to be a part of because he was in party mode, and I do get it. It's the holidays, y'all. So no hard feelings here. I just know that Judge Joe Brown will be back on another show on another day. Maybe before this trial is over, we'll get him to talk about the trial with us. But it won't be tonight. Listen, if you want to talk to me tonight, the call number is 515-605-9321. Then press 1. That's 515-605-9321. Then press 1. Okay, we're going to go to 817-740. Good evening. You're on Let's Talk Fort Worth.
Hey, Carrie. Good evening to you. Thank you for taking my call. I had to switch up phones because I just arrived at work, but I got a moment. Hey, Carrie, like you stated, and I'm listening, and, man, you know, my truly strength to you because you know, your platform is the voice of this community.
Wow.
You know, one of the many voices of this community. But I say, and I'm gonna say, your platform is the voice of this community. So it goes back to what you stated previously, the burden and the weight and everything that comes with it being placed on Zion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like
mm-hmm.
your words were just, you spoke those words, and it's like we are witnessing it.
Were you in the courtroom?
No, I haven't been down there, Carrie.
Okay.
I haven't been down there. But I thought, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not an attorney, neither are you, but I do have a little sense of how things work. If you are legally representing me, if I say anything contrary to what I've told you in the privacy of us having a discussion, as my attorney who's defending me, or no, representing me, okay, well, maybe I'm getting this wrong because Zion is not being, it's the state who's bringing her. The state
mm-hmm.
is bringing her. So maybe I'm misspeaking because Zion is not on trial. But I was taken back by the state's first day how they, you know, challenged something that Zion had said when the state is trying to focus its energy towards the person who's being defended by, you know what I'm saying, the person who's on trial.
So you caught when the state said what they said about Zion, like, didn't you
I caught that right off bunk. He said, hold on, but didn't you say, you don't remember the discussion we had? That right there, that's why we are where we are as far as people not even considering this young man's state of mind.
Yeah.
That night, everything, nobody considered that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Nobody's considering that. Now they're saying, here we go. And we had, Yosef and myself, we had a discussion in private. Mm-hmm. And I thank you for your words. You know, I listen. Like I tell you, I listen.
Good.
And as I listen to you tonight, it makes sense. When I saw him do that,
mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, my goodness. What are these mother? Mm-hmm. Oh, what are they doing?
Mm-hmm.
It's the defense's job to let this young man do his testimony. And it's their job to object to anything that's being said and then bring it up. But the fact that the state try to remind Zion of what he said, it says something about the system that's in place. We know the system that's in place. And I guarantee you this, Sharon Wilson, you got blood on your hands, and I guarantee you are making sure that this trial goes the way you want it to go. You making sure this trial has the outcome that you desire, Sharon Wilson. Yes, I said you got blood on your hands. As far as CPR is concerned, again, I'm not an officer. You're not an officer. But I'm sure that comes with training that they're supposed to learn life-saving measures just in case they, quote-unquote, you know, like they do, shoot somebody, that person is surviving. You got to stop them. You got to render aid. You just can't let that person die out. What if one of your officers, your coworkers, boom, get shot? Don't you have to render aid? Don't you have to do life-saving measures to? So if you – I didn't see her testimony, but I believe everything you're saying. If this neither of these individuals consider this the measure for CPR or life-saving measures for Tatiana, when Zion said that his aunt was crying, she was shaking and she was crying, that means she had life in her. That means there was an opportunity to save her. As far as the condition of the house, whose home isn't in disarray? But I don't even, like you said, I don't even take their words for it. Like you stated, when I heard that, first thing I said, without even hearing anybody else's opinion about it, oh, law enforcement did that. They ransacked that. You got to make it appear like it's, you had to make it appear like they couldn't care. They effed up. They effed up. They know it. They effed up. So they had to do whatever they got to do. They got to cover all bases. But you know what you said last, this I'm going to digress and I'm going to get off because I got to get in for these folks start looking for me. You said something that's powerful, Carrie. Regardless of which direction it's going, if he's found guilty, it's a win because it's going to show. If he's found guilty, it's going to show, okay, maybe the good old boy system, the system is working. Maybe it's working. Maybe it's working. Maybe there is a chance of people of color getting, you know, justice. But if they don't, then it just shows you that, so what they've been saying about this system all along is true. The council's decisions to not try to fix policing in neighborhoods, the community's relationship, when they voted that down weeks ago. This is an indictment on the council, too. So I'm going to let you...
Let me add this to what you're saying, though. Let me piggyback off this. You got a budget where you're giving them 80% of the budget. That's right. But you can't find the perfect police force with 80% of the budget. You're bringing in all these militarized weapons, but you can't train them right. So no matter what happens, y'all, we going to hold our heads up in Tarrant County and realize, you know what? If they let him go, the whole system just went on trial. Our city council, our mayor, our city manager, our DA's office, you know, everybody, the whole county, gets to be looked at as though something's wrong over there. This ain't Mayberry, and I think the whole world's gonna know it. If he gets off, the whole world's gonna say that ain't Mayberry, and we need to stop going there. So the migration that we've had to almost 1 million people may become a mass exodus. Maybe people at the visitor bureau may say, you know what, people ain't booking to come to Fort Worth no more because they heard about what happened to a Tatiana Jefferson. And if a person who is doing absolutely nothing can get killed in their home in the middle of the night for doing nothing, and the city says it's okay, and the jurors in that city say it's okay, then we don't want to go there. So, y'all, you know, either way.
Hey, Carrie, check this out also. So, if he gets off, that means law enforcement can go against all of the training is for nothing.
Yeah.
All of the training, all of the time they put into trying to become officers to make so they can make wise, concise, precise decisions. Muscle memory? No. You should be able to make this. Your decision making is based upon protecting life, preserving life. That's the first and foremost, to preserve life.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Preserve life at all costs, unless there's a threat. Miss Jefferson wasn't no threat. She wasn't no threat, and they can't tell us otherwise. We know. We know. Fort Worth, we know.
And I'll say this, too. This whole thing about fear for my life, perceived threat, that's got to be redefined, y'all. We can't do that because ain't nobody safe. If somebody can come to a window and be shot, then ain't nobody safe. And we're talking about a laser beam that ain't nobody seen, but he ain't going to get on the witness stand and tell us that he saw it. We're going to make that about an 11-year-old say it? Oh, come on, y'all. And I think the world is watching, and the world is watching you all re-traumatize a child. To put the child in her hand so the child can say, okay, well, it wasn't Aaron Dean that said it. Zion said it. That is evil. That is pure evil. That's just my opinion.
Wickedness in its highest form. Wickedness in its highest form. And last but not least, you know, we know Aaron Dean hasn't missed a meal. He hasn't missed any sleep. We know the forward POA. We know you're taking care of him. He quit. That was only his means of income. So we know Fort Worth POA, you're taking care of him, which your officers do. I wonder if they signed off on that Fort Worth POA, because I don't recall there being a GoFundMe for a killer. I never seen a GoFundMe for a killer. So thank you Fort Worth POA for all that you do to represent your officers, but you are the reason why the Fort Worth Police Department cannot take accountability and be credible. Carrie, thank you for taking my call. I continue listening. God bless you. We got some days to go. We got some time to go. Let's hold it together, y'all. Let's hold it together. And if it gotta come down, I'm not saying anything without saying it. If it gotta come down, it gotta come down. Peace.
Thank you, Adrian. We're gonna go to 940-399. Good evening. You're on Let's Talk Fort Worth.
Hey, Carrie, how you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. This is Christopher Moreno, and
hey,
I really, I don't even know where to start. You know, we've had conversation on social media for a while now, I listen to your show, and you really have everything, like, that's meaningful, articulated really well.
Wow.
This trial, what I've seen so far, for whatever, you know, you said something today about Fort Worth is on trial, this and everything is on trial, and I don't mean to downplay anything to do with any. I don't mean to downplay any of Aaron Dean's accountability. But people really need on this, okay? And, you know, forgiveness is part of it. Forgiveness is part of it, too. I mean, at some point. But people need to understand that Dean is a symptom of the sickness.
Mm.
You know, that He is the symptom of the sickness. And I'm not excusing his accountability, because that's why we have the law, to hold people accountable. But the one thing that I really find now that the trial's taken off, and I've seen it, you know, what we have to understand that this is the script. This is the pageantry that we've seen in Tarrant County's trials when a police officer is indicted. And usually not because they're not usually indicted because the DA advocated for the indictment. They're indicted because some other party or the grand jury themselves seen the new, you know, it's a whole different spiel with the grand jury than it is with the trial jury, and people don't understand all of this technical, and they shouldn't have to, you know. I mean, our public leaders and our public officials should have the integrity to deal with this stuff and communicate to us, but I just wish that people, if people would really get informed and educated and read about cases. But what I was saying is, this is just the same pageantry and the same script that we have seen. And you know, right now it's really in focus for the last few years over Sharon Wilson. But this is 100 years, thousands of years. But, you know, in America, we in Fort Worth, 100 years, you know, the first, I won't get into, but the script here, we've seen this same script, the same characters playing out with Courtney Johnson, John Romer, Fort Worth police officer, Willie Brown, Barone, I mean, Bengal, the same thing. And really the point that I want to say, and this is what I'll say, I think the DA is doing – Derek, I mean, personality-wise, they're doing pretty good for what. But you're right; you've landed it. They're not following the law. The big deal that I had right when I knew that this was going to get really crazy was whenever they recused Judge Hagerman, because you know, we heard a lot of, in my opinion, fraudulent claims about, oh, it's about vacation, oh, it's about the Jim Lane's health, oh, it's about all of this and all of that. And I said, I'm going to tell you what it is about, in my opinion. My very factually based inference is that the reason Judge Hagerman was recused is because Judge Hagerman is the only felony court judge in Tarrant County who has presided over a case and sentenced a Fort Worth police officer to hard time in the pen.
Got you. Okay. And, well, remember, let's be clear, John Romer never went to jail. He's been out on an appeal bond, and now he's asking for a new trial, right?
He got a new trial. The second court of appeals on October 28th, I think, right before Election Day. Kind of crazy, you know, how we don't get this from the mainstream media or from, you know, you see Sharon Wilson advertising all of this hype on her website every time she nails somebody, like, you know. And I'm not downplaying. I'm not a police hater. I'm not anything. But this is about 14th Amendment, equal protection under the law. This is about the Constitution. This is about the penal code. This trial here is about the penal code, right? And you said it. People have a right to be, you know, a Fourth Amendment right to be secure in their homes.
Let me ask you this. You know, and y'all, Chris is very intelligent. Seriously, no joke. He is on top of what's going on in this county. When you watched opening statements, though, the prosecution was a little better today. But what did you think of opening statements for the prosecution?
The whole distraction here is that it really comes down to the fact that we're talking about general orders and training manuals. And no, Aaron Dean isn't those. And this is the big thing that people misunderstand, this internal affairs concept, those general orders and those training manuals and all of this, everything, pretty much almost 95% of this testimony that we've heard, that these prosecutors, they're trying to draw out these facts for the jury. All of this stuff about Code 56, this, that, whatever, that is not the law. That a district court, that Judge Gallagher is supposed to be regulating to the jury. This jury, okay, those codes and those general orders and everything, those are for administrative disciplinary proceedings, okay?
Oh,
and what we're gearing up here too is you're going to have, and I mean, the jury at the end of the day, their instruction is going to be on the penal code, on the elements of murder. It's not going to be on the elements of a general orders violation, you know?
Really?
It's semantics. Really? This is the problem that we get into with semantics and nuances, and, you know, you got to deal with those, as in the trial, those matters are going to come up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you do have to deal with those facts, so whatever. But I have heard nothing from the I have seen no angle of attack from the prosecution.
Yep.
And it just seems to be going completely under the radar, the elements of murder.
Mhm. Mhm.
Okay? And here, let me just make one last thing that I want to say. You know, and like I said, I'm not downplaying Aaron Dean. But this is a cultural thing, and this is a thing. I'm a white person, and you know, I've grown up in I've been through some adversity. The black community, okay, this separation and this division that we have in our world about race or ethnicity or religion or language or this or that or whatever. Come on, man. It's like, what? Dude, I kind of lost my train of thought here.
No.
We're
divided.
Right.
They're dividing
us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They are dividing us.
Mm-hmm.
The system and this underworld of cronyism, profiteering and politics, and it's just. But what I want to say is, we need to be talking about murder. We're not talking about general order. There's nothing in the general orders. You know, if they want to waive these, you know, I saw yesterday in the opening statements, and this is what I'm saying about Judge, the difference between Judge Hagerman, the reputation, what I've read about Judge Hagerman, I don't have any personal knowledge, but I've done a lot of research. Judge Hagerman is a very, very strict disciplinarian on both sides. He fought, what I've heard that is he keeps his courtroom on the rails. And what I was saying about the script and the pageantry and the characters, these are the same exact characters that we see play out in every single, epic scene of police misconduct, police brutality, police dishonesty. We see Jim Lane, Tim Choi, Brissette, Bob Gill. That's the same characters that we see, and it's just time to ask a question. It's just time to ask the question. You know, I understand there's a lot of rhetoric out there of, you know, that they need a defense, they need this that, and I said, but what I'm seeing in this trial, the pattern, you know, is this is just another cookie cutter. And, you know, we keep taking the cake. I mean, it's time to say, I don't want
to eat the cake anyway, right. Let me ask you this, because I tried to break it down as best as I could remember what Carol Darch was saying today, Officer Carol Darch, by the way. Define what she was talking about when she's talking about muscle memory. How is that relative?
It's not. It's hype. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm not personal. I'm not putting her down personally because, like I said, I can't. Just like I said about Aaron Dean, I don't know what you do about it. you know, elections or this, that, whatever. But we've come to a point where,
yeah,
and I mean, I was really proud. I was really proud of James today because because he wasn't taking none of it. I kind of got a vibe with him on another level, but you know, it's a brotherhood vibe, the DA, and what the other thing is too, what we're seeing too, what I'm seeing is too, is there's this thing. What I'm getting is this subterfuge that everybody's being, all of the DA and everybody and the judge are being real careful that what they don't want is the policing in general on trial, okay? Because of what's going on with BLM and all of that. But that's not relevant. That is not relevant either. This trial needs to be focused on the facts and
the testimony and
the evidence.
I saw the prosecution today try to clean up this whole thing about training and whether or not general orders were followed and this, that, and the other. And so I saw when the defense tried to make it about training and the prosecution countered that, you know, training, you all didn't knock on the door, you all didn't do this, you all didn't announce yourself, you all, yeah. So you didn't follow general orders. You didn't check to see if the door was open, you know, that type of thing. So I'm really afraid of, tell them how you described to me what Jim Lane's defense tactic was going to be. Explain that part.
Okay, there's a history. And like I said, this is not personal. You know, we can sit here and hold a scorecard. I'm not attacking his personal character at all. But his legal theory, it originates, in 1970, Jim Lane became prominent because of the My Lai massacre. Him and F. Lee Bailey and a couple of other attorneys who were kind of like super-duper superstars in the defense attorney industry for decades now, they came up with – so during the My Lai massacre, this was during the Vietnam War, it was a court-martial against some soldiers who did a very dastardly thing, and I'm not going to get into that. A lot of people know about it, but – they went into a village and it was terrible, you know. And Jim Lane was in the Army as a JAG officer. He was a captain and he represented three of the lower, I think the lower enlisted. He didn't represent the ones that you hear about, the commanders and the cap. I forget what his name is, Captain, and the lieutenant. He represented the ones who were actually the ones who did it, you know, and so what he goes off of is this, computer science theory of automatism, right? And this kind of feeds into the whole thing, and it's a play, and this trial is a perfect, setup for that argument, because you have the dispatcher, right? So basically what this whole defense theory is that they want to sit here and play Tatiana's murder up as a thin, you remember syntax error, right?
Mm-mm.
It just means that somewhere along the line somebody punched in the wrong keys and it programmed this RoboCop Aaron Dean make a mistake. And so because whoever put the wrong keystrokes in, like you were saying earlier, and you know what, Chris, I've worked in the criminal justice system, rehabilitating youth, and they have this book called Pathways, and they talk about criminal thinking errors, the criminal mind, you know, kind of like to rehabilitate. They talk about blaming others, right? Downplaying. There's like three or four little, there's a cycle of criminal of thinking errors that you get into that they train these people who get out on probation. They try to rehabilitate them and tell them, you know, don't downplay, accept consequences, all of this. And this is a point that I was making earlier about the black community and everything. You know what? This justice isn't supposed to be vindictive. It's supposed to be productive. constructive as a community. And if I have perfect faith that, you know, that if Aaron Dean had held himself accountable and released a statement or came out and said, look, with my attorney, I made a grave, egregious error. I confess. I confess that I was I was out of my element, and I'm no longer copying anymore, right? And this, that, whatever. But this thing, what we're seeing now is the cleat and no, man. What we've seen in the script is just like with Courtney Johnson, just like with Dennis Romer. Dennis Romer has been out, got convicted, had a sentence over his head, and he spent the last 2 years trying to get his job back with the Fort Worth Police Department. I mean, that's what's been going on in the background. And Courtney Johnson, what everybody thinks about this Courtney Johnson guy who shot Gregory Adams with a shotgun on accident, whatever. That doesn't happen on accident. Police departments and we're going to be getting into the gun, the pistol, the function of the pistol. I'm going to tell you, police departments, they proof their weapons very well. Those weapons, the hammer, what you have to do you have to half cock a pistol, you know, holster it and this, that, to be able to get off a center mass shot within like a flinch of a second, and take a lethal shot on somebody. So when Aaron Dean walked through that gate, I'm 99.99% sure he walked through that gate, right? He unholstered his weapon. He's amped up like he's playing Call of Duty. He ain't out there. This is a call for service. This ain't Call of Duty, you know? And
hold on, listen. Hold that thought. So for anybody who's tuning in, I apologize. Judge Brown is not with us tonight. I know a lot of you all probably wanted him and I did too, but I only booked Judge Jill Brown on yesterday. He had a prior engagement, a Christmas party, and Judge Joe Brown has already got in holiday mode. So that said, he was not prepared to do this show tonight. And I love him so much, I would never bring him on the show that he was not prepared to do. And so because he's in holiday mode, we're going to let him continue to party, and we're going to bring him back at another day. So I apologize to anyone who tuned in for Judge Joe Brown. He will not be with us tonight because he's at a prior engagement, and I booked him, and he wanted so badly to do the show. He was going to do it from the party. And I was like, nah, that's not, you know, because we're talking 2 hours, Joe. We need to hear our judge. I'm sorry, the Honorable Judge Joe Brown. But we needed him for the whole 2 hours, and he was just going to be able to chime in. And he was already festive and in a good mood and having a good time. And I did not want to break the mode. I want him to continue to have that party, and we'll just bring him back later. So again, for anybody just tuning in, that's what's going on. If you have a question or a comment, the call-in number tonight is 515-605-9321. Then press 1 once connected. That's 515-605-9321. Then press 1 once connected. The number's at the top of your screen if you're listening via the internet. Okay, so hold on, Chris. Let's go back. So Lane's defense. And he was Lane, Jim Lane, just passed away the day before jury selection, was the lead attorney for Aaron Dean. And so you believe that his defense is going to ultimately come down to he was on autopilot as a RoboCop.
I mean, this is figurative speech, but, you know, it would take it's like a long essay to explicate the doctrine, you know. But that's typically what happened with those guys. He got 3 guys off in the My Lai massacre simply because he said they were following orders.
Wow.
Okay.
And that kind of went the way the testimony was kind of going, that a whole lot of issues was around general orders today. So, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So that's where to go. Okay.
It's scary. I'm going to trump this up because I am a combat veteran. I've been there. I've been in the thickness of it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a whole different scenario than what policing is. okay? And, you know, we've seen this thing coming up in Uvalde and this and that, whatever. The difference mm-hmm. between a soldier and a – and I'm not putting cops down in general, okay? Mm-hmm. But there is a culture that of questionable mm-hmm. of questionable issues. Soldiers and firefighters, they go into the danger, okay? When there's a kid screaming in a window, the mm-hmm. soldiers don't sit there and squirt water for, you know, pull out their hoses and squirt water. No. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a certain point there where, I mean, doing the right thing is just, it's like Jesus said, to lay your life down for another. You know, mm-hmm. there's no greater honor than to lay your life down for another. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, at a
mm-hmm.
certain point, that's what you have a badge for. You know, I mean, that's why they play bagpipes and taps and everything. That's why you get all the honor when you die, is because the thing is there is that you are supposed to take a risk. You're not supposed to walk in. I mean, fear. We're hearing about, oh, all of this trauma that Darks was talking about today. Oh, and I'm empathetic. I'm sympathetic because I have PTSD and I have been through this. But where is the fortitude? I mean, where is the intestinal fortitude and the strength of character? Like I said, what I see in that video and what I've seen in the factual narrative that they can't get around is that these cops, a lot of these cops these days are out there and they're on this call of duty mentality that, you know, they're just going to point. And because I know I'm a scatterbrained. I'm all over the place. This is just a shotgun blast of information mm-hmm. because I'm really frustrated because people aren't really like, aren't little details matter a lot, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they build up. And so we have a open structure call, right? And you
mm-hmm.
have two rookies that are responding and you have two rookies that are responding to that. They get there. If factually it is the case that you have an open structure call and you walk up and they say what they look through the window, oh, it was ransacked, this, that, whatever. Okay. In my opinion, okay, there's no exigent thing going on. You don't hear no screaming, yelling, this, whatever. You have a silent, calm little situation. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If they perceive that it was burglary and they were going to go half-cocked, call of duty, they should have called a supervisor in. They should have called that up on the log. You know, if it's going to go from open structure to, well, they should have called dispatch and said this was a, you know, kind of like assess it as an open structure, which is a call for service, a convenience call.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to play this out that this is some kind of, no. So you get there, if it's factual that they, I mean, this is just common sense reason. If I'm just like what James said today on the stand, he walked over there. He kind of got a little bit of the heebie-jeebies because it was a macabre situation, right? An unusually
mm-hmm.
macabre situation. Cold night, doors open, 2 o'clock in the morning, fine. He didn't specifically factually say that there was an emergency or any kind of exigent circumstance that required a SWAT takedown. Come on.
Hmm.
But
and you know what,
he was smart enough to know, look, I'm not going to go creeping up on this situation like that, right? So he had a call for service because that's why we have police, to be brave, to have the knowledge.
And I agree. Let me say this. First of all, anybody who disagrees with the police in Fort Worth is considered anti-police, which is just wrong to begin with. First of all, good police officers ought to want other good police officers as their backup. So
mm-hmm.
nobody's saying that all police are bad.
I
never said that. I've had law enforcement people in my own family. So it's not about being anti-police, but you want bad cops gone. Everybody should want bad cops gone. And so a good cop should be analytical. He should be well-trained. He should be good at assessing the situation. He should be discerning. He should have a gut instinct about what's going on, and he should not be reactionary. He should not come there with preconceived notions about what's going on. He's supposed to come there, and his training is supposed to determine what he does next, not automatically already determining what he thinks is going on. Your training and all of those training manuals and general orders that they kept referring to is supposed to give you some type of assessment as to what you're dealing with. And when the doors were open, y'all never even bothered to knock on them, ring a doorbell, or even try to open the door to see if it was open. You didn't hear any bumping going around. You didn't hear any talking. So obviously that said to me, pause and pay attention to what's going on. And you got two doors. You got two people. Y'all both couldn't be peeping in the doors. Somebody couldn't say hello, so we're here to help. Is there a problem? Is everybody okay?
Yeah.
None of that.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Crack
so
the door open. Hello, hello, hello. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to understand, like, at what point does it come into play to this defense team that these people responded to this call wrong? And somebody made a good point on social media. Even an open call does not say an open structure does not say danger. An open structure says, hey, this door is supposed to be closed. This window is supposed to be closed. So let's investigate to determine why is it open. That's an open structure.
My point about this whole transition from open structure to there being some kind of ransacked home, a burglary in progress, right? Okay?
Right.
That's those two officers doing their role-playing, their Call of Duty role-playing. Because if that was if that was factually legitimate, then their training should have told them as two officers, you don't just have the discretion. If you have – That means what you want to do when you have a burglary in progress, they will station like four officers on the adjacent streets, and you guys will cordon the area because people will pop out of it. I had this happen to me when I was living in Killeen. One day I was home, and I caught somebody breaking into my neighbor's house. I just jumped up in my bathtub window and looked out and saw him crash in a window and creeping in. I called the cops, went out. They came down. One of them came running. And they are discreet. It's true. That's fine. They are discreet. But what they did was they assessed the situation, right? And then they said, we're going to wait because we're going to get officers on the back street. We're waiting because we've got officers coming in. Like, you don't even see. They're going to be stationed on the street over in case he jumps out the back door and hops the fence and goes down that street, right? But what you sit here and say, if there was a burglary in progress, he would have called that up on the radio, and his supervisor probably would have told them, hey, y'all need to stand down until we get back up on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's phony. It's fraudulent.
I agree.
Fraudulent.
Let's go. Adrian has another. No. I want to ask you some more questions, Chris. Adrian,
okay.
You're back on.
Hey, give me 1 second, Carrie. I want to clear my background. 1 second.
Okay. So you got to pay attention, y'all. Once you turn 18, my mom says it like this best, choices and consequences, choices and consequences. So when you get older, you realize everything you do has a consequence to it. So we can't have officers out there on the street who don't understand choices and consequences. And then if you make the wrong choice, then you got a consequence, and you got to take responsibility for it and not blame everybody else. That's simple. Something's wrong with
Aaron. Carrie,
I'm
sorry. I'm back. Just quick observation. Quick observation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the mind state of the two officers. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I heard part of Carol Deutsch. I'm going to take you into her mind state, but let me take you into Aaron Dean's mind state first.
Mm-hmm.
I learned Aaron Dean's mind state based off of his hormone. I learned Aaron Dean's mind state based off of his police interview.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
If people revisit that, you will know Aaron Dean's mind state as to why he wants to be an officer. Mm. Aaron Dean was on it. Again, Aaron Dean, this is my opinion. This has nothing to do with Let's Talk Forward. She put her disclaimer out. This is Adrian speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Dean was on an adventure that night. He was on an adventure that night. And it speaks to what Chris is saying about this Call of Duty mindset. Aaron Dean was on an adventure that night.
Wow.
Now fast forward to call, they placed Aaron Dean in the exact area they know that would benefit his way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Now fast forward to Carol Deutsch. They asked the question, why did you want to be a law enforcement?
Yeah.
What area did you want to work in? I wanted to work in the East Side. Why the East Side?
Mm-hmm.
Because you get it's a lot going on over there. It's a lot going on. It's a lot of action.
Mm-hmm.
Blah, 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 blah. You know what? They placed her exactly where she wanted to be,
mm-hmm.
where they would have a possibility of putting whatever it is they've learned in the academy to use. And
mm-hmm.
what other way can you put what you've learned in the police academy to use but in the communities that are deemed the less of every in the communities that are individuals deemed the less of everybody?
Mm-hmm.
That's her own words. Carol Deutsch
wow.
was placed in that community, the East Side. It's amazing how she know exactly where she was working. I think it's this. I think it goes from this to this. Oh yeah, Carol Deutsch, you see exactly where she wanted to be. They put over there exactly where she wanted to be. She was on. She got some action at night. They didn't
mm-hmm.
put her nowhere where she wouldn't get action. And that was just two things that stuck. Those are some observations that has stood out to me now. Now that I hear you all continuing on with the mindset possibly of law enforcement. So
and
you
tell
think
you
about that.
Let me say this too. I think the prosecution was alluding to the fact that Carol Deutsch and Aaron Dean know each other better than she admitted. First of all,
mm-hmm.
she tried to pretend like they work in the same station, but she didn't really know him, blah, blah, blah. But she kept, the prosecution kept kind of nudging, how well do y'all know each other? Why did you take the call that night? Because I did not know your backup is not assigned. Your backup chooses to go on your backup. I did not know that. I learned something today. So she said she chose that call to back him up that night. So, you know, here you got it. You know, you wanted to go on a call where you said you understood it to be an open structure. So it wasn't like the system chose you and said, hey, you're it. You need to back him up. She chose to go as his backup that night. So
hey,
very telling.
Carrie,
I believe they knew each other.
What we grew up with, Carrie, what's the saying we grew up with in our communities? Birds of a feather? Flock together.
And remember they kept talking about the parking. Remember they kept talking about the parking lot where they all hung out at. Obviously, Dean and her both hung out in that parking lot where all those officers hang out. Y'all remember that part of the testimony? It was some parking lot.
They've had discussions regarding what they've been doing while they're on the beat. Hey, you remember the other night? Yeah, that was me. You get that call? That was me.
I guarantee they've had those discussions. I bet they're hanging out over there with those pistol belts off.
right.
Thank you again, Kevin.
You know,
take my call.
Wait a minute. And don't even forget, Darch claims that her body cam, did she say the body cam? Some kind of way the body cam, y'all, she claimed got stolen and she had put in for a new one. Don't forget that part. And then she couldn't remember which side Aaron Dean's body cam was on. Was it on the right or was it on the left? You know, her memory was just real all over the place. But I just think it was very funny. She said her body cam some kind of way got stolen. And so she didn't have her body cam on that night, and they did not activate the dash cam. So you have no dash cam footage from her, nor do you have her body cam footage. I don't know. Just in my opinion,
Carrie,
I believe
that's a part of her
gun instead.
Huh?
That's a part of their PPI, or how you call it, when they dress out. You got to have everything. Hey, Chris, I can relate to you on the military side. We couldn't leave without nothing. We got to keep our gear together. So when they call us to do something, we got to put our gear on and go. We can't be missing nothing.
You can't even have – when you go on – shit happens when you get in the heat, but once you leave out on mission, once you SP the FOB, right? You pull out of your base. If you got a shoelace out of place, you're checking each other, man, all the time. And anybody would
know that. You know what? And that's an excellent point. You on the East Side, what you said is full of drugs. You said the South Side is full of drugs and full of crime. Everything that could possibly go wrong happens on the South Side. But you are out there without a body camera on. That does not make sense. That does not make sense. Somebody lied. Mm-hmm. I hate to see somebody lying. That just does not make sense. Why would you be on the east side on the midnight shift with no body camera on? And you're a female.
And here's, I'll give this one. We came up with this thing that you was talking about, the flashlight, this green laser. Did Aaron Dean do this? Mm-hmm. Turn it on or turn it off? But there's one other point that really popped off in my head when Dart said it. They were talking about the audio on Aaron Dean's body cam, how it was in and out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He specifically said that he hit mute. That is a violation. That is obstruction of justice,
wow.
Girl.
That right there is
tampering with evidence, and that should have been thrown on with the charge of murder because you were on an active scene. It's a state law now, Bose Law, from the Geiger case. They passed the legislation that police must, while they are in an active situation or interacting with persons in an active investigative capacity, it has to be on all full
immediately. Yes, sir.
From start to finish until you get removed, until that whole sheet, like they keep talking about the sheet, until the sheet has been terminated by, you know, whoever. It's completely, you close the case out and you go home and go to sleep, that thing has to stay on. You can't mute it. That's obstruction.
And you know what? This whole city has basically been put on a gag order since this trial. And you know what? You know, Joshua Brown, we know, this is, in my opinion, this case is resembling starting to look a whole lot like Amber Geiger's trial. That said, we pray there's no Joshua Brown to get hurt, Chief Noakes. We pray nobody gets killed for talking about this, but if it does, it's just going to be another indictment on this city, on this police department, on this DA's office, that part. So if it's starting to look like the Amber Geiger trial, let's just make sure there's no Joshua Brown. And everybody has the right to talk about this trial. And I just don't get the gag order. I don't get trying to put the whole city under chokehold for one man. And my question is, does the whole city, the whole county go down for one man? Who's really on trial here? Because if we are going to sacrifice the whole city, possibly have all kind of people come in here and tear this place up because of the wrong verdict, are we really willing to do that for one man? That's crazy. I mean, that's just my opinion. To me, that's crazy. That makes no sense. So who's really on trial? Is it Aaron Dean or the Fort Worth Police Department? Is it Aaron Dean or the city of Fort Worth? Because who sacrifices that much for one man?
Another observation regarding depending on what the way this case goes, the verdict goes, the possible uprising, they got to realize Fort Worth is smaller than Dallas.
Mm.
It'll happen a whole lot faster. It'll happen a whole lot faster in Fort Worth than it would Dallas. These little areas they covet so much, they will be destroyed a whole lot faster than Dallas is such a wide, like, big cities. You have groups of people coming out. Fort Worth is small. It's not going to take much. If people wanted to go that route, I'm just saying, if they wanted to go that route, I'm not in no way advocating for it.
But I'm just trying to understand, like, they're already a protested in New York about a Tatiana Jefferson. You got celebrities like Rihanna already talking about it. You know, so you got to realize that it is getting on the radar. It's been slow coming, but it is getting on the radar. When people are saying, what the hell happened down there? Why is that girl dead? And for the world to then see that nobody is held accountable, it puts the whole city and the whole county and the whole police department on trial, in my opinion, if that happens. And it just says, it just reeks that something else is going on. You got somebody who's not a criminal, not in the commission of a crime, you know, a med student, finished college, you know, in her own home, minded her own business, playing with her nephew, and she's somehow dead. But nobody's going to be held accountable for it. And you want to tell us that an officer's on autopilot, that you got on the street, and that's okay, that he killed her? That doesn't even make sense. I mean, that really does not make sense to me. And I think that's where it's going. And you got the whole city scared to talk about it. Do I talk about this tonight with some fear in me? I do. But at the same time, y'all, you know what? I'm going to tell y'all like Dick Gregory told me one time. Dick Gregory said, and I'm just going to put it in the ways that he said it. I asked him, I said, so, Mr. Gregory, how is it that you were able to talk about all the things that you talked about in the middle of the Jim Crow era? And Dick Gregory said this to me. And remember, Dick Gregory said the N-word just like he said the C-word. So he didn't discriminate. And so he said to me, if the God I serve cannot if the God I serve cannot protect me from some crackers, I'm serving the wrong God. Now, I don't even use that word, but I'm just telling you, he used the N-word just like he used the C-word. So it ain't about, you know, that. But he made that point to me. And so I say tonight, I think we're all going to be covered, because I think what happened with this trial, the veil is being pulled up. The whole city, the whole county, the whole police department is over, is being analyzed by everybody now. Stuff has been hidden. Stuff that people have been complaining about and people pretended didn't exist is now coming to the forefront. So the veil has been lifted. And so when it continues after this point, it's just like when someone spills a Coca-Cola in Kroger. If they spill the Coca-Cola at 9 o'clock and someone slips and falls by 9:30, they can say, you know what, Kroger didn't have time to realize that there was a problem. But if somebody slips and falls in Kroger at 2 o'clock, then Kroger is open to be sued. Why? Because they had enough time to know that there was a problem on that aisle and they didn't fix it. So the same with Fort Worth. After this trial, the veil has been lifted. No more lies. Can't say it ain't a problem with the police department. You can't say your police department is not moving like a gang. You can't say that the DA has refused to convict cops. You cannot say any of that anymore. You cannot say the city has not been complicit with allowing officers to move like a gang. The city has not turned their head repeatedly when people have complained about police harassment, like myself, repeatedly through several police chiefs, through the mayor, through my entire city council, and nothing has ever been done. So the veil has been lifted off of Fort Worth and Tarrant County, and this trial did it for us. So no matter what happens, it's a win. Y'all can let him go, but we still win. And if you convict him, you're just doing the right thing.
Right.
Period. And that's not a comma behind that. That's a period. No matter what happens, I consider it a win. That's the truth. No matter what happens, it's a win, because Fort Worth can no longer pretend that there ain't a problem. They can no longer pretend that these officers are going to work and doing their job. They can no longer pretend that they are not paying attention to police protocol when they're out here on these streets. They can no longer pretend that. So what happens after this? It's just like spilling the Coke in Kroger. You have enough time now to know that there's a problem. The problem is, will Fort Worth do something about it? So until Friday night, good night, y'all.
Night. Later, Carrie.
Good night.